Blog Talk Radio.
This is Military Monday on the Right Stream Radio Network. I am your host, John Gresham, and it is a beautiful day today here in sunny Fairfax, Virginia. It's hard to believe, just a couple of months ago we were praying that we would ever have days like this, but it is summer and we are here today to talk about something that is strikingly passionate with so many Americans. And that is the American Civil War. We happen to be in the middle, and I mean literally in the middle, of the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War. This particular year, we are watching closely various events here in Virginia following the Overland Campaign of 1864, where the Union Army... Specifically the Army of the Potomac under Ulysses S. Grant and General George Meade, fought against Robert E. Lee and eventually set up the siege of Richmond and Petersburg. But we're going to talk a little today about the men who did the leadership part of the Civil War. We talk a lot about the Civil War in terms of its sometimes grotesque numbers. The casualties, the size of the armies, the amazing size of the battles, which were large even by the biggest European standards. And we have today with us a very, very interesting gentleman who is the author now of 9 books. His day job is, in fact, as a homicide detective with the Chicago Police Department, but he is here today as a Zenith Press author of the book, The Civil War Generals. Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Girardi. Are you there, Robert?
Yes, I am. Thank you, and good morning to everybody.
Robert, you know, you've got a pretty interesting job, you know, being a homicide cop in a major city. One does not doubt it, the job's ability to fascinate, horrify, and amaze you throughout a lifetime, yet you are known throughout the Civil War community as really one of the top authors, speakers, and enthusiasts within the context of the Civil War as a subject. And I'm going to ask a simple question. Why in God's name does it attract you so much? And for that matter, why does it attract attention, not just in America, but across the world, as the leading subject for history books in this country and elsewhere?
Well, personally, for me, I grew up during the centennial, and as you mentioned, now it's the sesquicentennial, or the 150th anniversary. Growing up as a kid, I can remember always being fascinated with the Civil War from the earliest time and through school. Whenever I had papers or anything to write, if I could, I did it about the Civil War. It's just been part of me forever. Nationwide and popularly, I think it's such a dramatic bloodletting, such an upheaval in this country. It divided us, and it redefined and reunited us and made us the nation we became. It made us capable of becoming that nation. It was something that the Founding Fathers deferred wisely or unwisely, but sooner or later it had to be dealt with. And I think just the interpersonal nature of it, the way that it touched every life in that time period. Nobody was unaffected by the war, unlike today where the war is a distraction. We're a nation at war and many people don't even realize it. Back then, everybody knew.
Because everybody had someone who was in the Army or had a family that had lost someone in the Army. I mean, the casualties on both sides still dwarf even World War One and World War Two. Over 600,000 soldiers on both sides who died from various causes during the war. That's a big number.
Well, put it in perspective, roughly 2% of the population. In today's numbers, that would be about 7 million people.
And I'm trying to imagine Americans today committed to a military endeavor somewhere in the world, not necessarily on U.S. soil, but somewhere, and putting up with 7 million dead over a period of 4 or 5 years.
Today we cannot fathom a sacrifice or loss on that scale. We just can't. We lament, and rightfully so, we lament the loss of one soldier on the battlefield, but some towns in the Civil War in one day lost all their young men.
And let us not kid ourselves, this was the first war of any real size in which a revolution in armaments had come about. Cannons were firing charges much greater range, with much greater accuracy, and with much greater effect. And then, of course, there was this minor technical revolution that came about because of a French colonel by the name of Claude Mini, who invented a new kind of bullet. And from that came the mass slaughters that we saw at places like Pickett's Charge, Cold Harbor, and other places.
Yeah, that's right. And sadly, tactics were based on Napoleonic grand scale battle lines, men standing shoulder to shoulder firing volleys, but with muskets. I mean, there were rifles in the Napoleonic Wars, but those were specialty troops. In the Civil War, just about everybody had rifled muskets, which gave you greater killing range and less opportunity to affect an attack, because by the time you got to the defense, you were obliterated.
And the tactics of the day, which had, as you said, been copied from the Napoleonic era, simply had not been updated to accommodate the greater lethality of the new weapon systems.
No, it was in transition. There was it was in the process of being learned, but unfortunately it was being learned in practice, which meant men would die.
Yeah, and unfortunately a lot of people who learned the lesson learned it the hard way and went down and died as a result, because the nature of wounds changed. I mean, if you got hit and you had a wound that went to a bone, your chances of if you survived the golden hour, as we would say today, your chances of actual survival were only 1 in 3, and you probably would have an amputation.
Right. Yeah, it was very scary, very scary times to be in combat. But then I think it always is. As weapons improve, until leaders adapt to the weapons, soldiers pay the price.
And this leads us to the question, okay, we had this massive war, and in terms of army size as a percentage of the population, it was, as you point out, a very large percentage of the U.S. population, certainly as big or greater than World War II. And here you have these huge armies. I mean, when George Meade arrived on the battlefield at Gettysburg, and he arrived late. They'd already been fighting for a day before he got there. He was commanding an army of roughly 90 to 100,000 troops. Lee had one that was also in double digits of thousands. I mean,
right.
These were huge, huge armies, and someone had to command and control them. Now, you and I would call these people generals.
That's right.
What was it like? What was the role of a general, be it a brigadier, a one-star, or one of the generals of the army like Grant or Lee? What was the scope of their responsibilities and missions during that time?
Well, Starting from the top, an Army commander is responsible for all the movements, all the planning, strategy, and putting that strategy into effect on the battlefield tactically. Not necessarily for an Army commander to get involved in the tactical fighting of a battle. His job is more grand strategy and logistics, getting his armies where they need to be with what they need to fight. The subordinate generals, corps commanders, division, and brigade commanders, they're the ones in charge of the tactical deployment and really the fighting of the battles. They're the ones who are going to determine what happens on the battlefield. A brigadier general, being the smallest of those, is going to coordinate a small unit and try to fight it with effect. And oftentimes what a brigadier general it does is going to affect things from the bottom up rather than from the top down.
Now, we hear the term brigadier general. We know those today as one stars. And there is an obvious connection to the idea that a brigadier general commands a brigade. What was a brigade like in terms of numbers of units and numbers of men in the American Civil War?
Okay, well, this changes with time. Let's start. In theory, Civil War armies were primarily made of volunteers, so they came from local communities. A regiment would be, on paper, roughly 1,000 officers and men, led by a colonel. Two, three, or four regiments would form a brigade led by a brigadier general. So a four-regiment brigade, on paper, would be 4,000 men at full strength. Two or three, led by a brigadier general, a one-star. Two or three brigades would form a division. So now you're multiplying that number of four by two or three. So a division, a full-strength division, would be approximately 12,000 men. And then a corps would be two or three divisions. And then two or three Army Corps would make an army. And that's how you get from your regiment of 1,000 to your Gettysburg Army of 100,000. Of course, because of attrition, because of sickness, because of many other factors, including battlefield deaths, most Civil War units were at half strength or less almost immediately. So a regiment of 1,000.
Talk a little bit about the fact. Yeah, and please talk about the fact that just being in an army camp entitled you to an early death in many cases, just living with that many people.
In the era of the Civil War, the country was still mostly rural. So when you start forming, especially at the beginning of the war, these large army camps, usually on county fairgrounds or in some places where the men were being housed were stables, barns, where not too recently occupied by or not until very recently occupied by cows or pigs. So imagine living and sleeping in those quarters. And then, of course, the contagious or infectious diseases that many people did not get as children, which affect you much more severely as you get older. And then, of course, sanitary conditions, bad water, bad food. Diseases ran rampant, and oftentimes as many as a third of a regiment would be unfit for combat before they ever got out of camp.
But so the realities were that even if you were a commander of a brigade, you might have a badly depleted unit when you were ordered to go and march to an enemy battlefield.
That's right. Oftentimes, as many as a third, sometimes half of a unit would be wiped out in camp. And over the course of the war, two-thirds of those who died from disease rather than being killed on the battlefield. Now, some of those, of course, were complications of wounds, but most of them were from common diseases. Germs were something that were unheard of at the time. But even so, the mortality rate in the Civil War was an improvement over the Mexican War, just a few years before.
Despite the massive increase in lethality of the weapons being used.
Right. Disease, sanitary conditions were still, germs, still the biggest killers of men.
One has to wonder what it would have been like if they'd gone into battle 20 years later after the work of Louis Pasteur and some of the other scientists around the world had finally figured out some of the more visible microbes and other small disease-causing critters.
Many men who had died probably would not have.
Now,
we've talked about
the size and numbers of these units. Let's talk a little bit about the men who would command them. What was it to be an officer in the American Civil War? How did you become one, and what sort of paths would you have taken to get there?
Well, at the beginning of the war, the Army of the United States, prior to the Civil War, including officers, was about 16,000 men, and they were scattered over the frontier on both coasts, in garrisons. So most commanders, most officers of the 1,000 or so officers, most of them had never even commanded a full regiment because they'd only served in detachments. So there were only 5 generals in the Army at the beginning of the war, and none of them had ever led anything of the size or scope of what Civil War armies would be. At Yorktown, George Washington had a force, if you exclude the French, he only had about 10,000 men. And the biggest army that Winfield Scott had in Mexico was about 12,000. A Civil War division was more than 12,000. Civil War Army Corps were somewhere between 15,000 in the Union and 35,000 men in the Confederate. And Army commands were talking near 100,000 men. Nobody was prepared for this war or to lead it. Now, part of the problem was the nature of the United States and believing in a small army. For good or bad, that was policy. So none of these men, even though skilled or trained at the United States Military Academy at West Point or Virginia Military Institute, the Citadel in South Carolina, or other comparable places, none of these men were prepared to lead armies of this scope and scale. And there just weren't enough officers to command the size and the number of armies that were being raised. So they had to come from somewhere, and they came from civilian life. Many men, if you could raise a regiment, you would be a colonel. You might have been a lawyer or a storekeeper or any civilian occupation. But now, because you raised a regiment, you get a colonelcy. And if you're connected,
so in other words, if you could afford to put a uniform on 1,000 men, put a pack on their back, the United States would hand you a musket and a cartridge belt, and you could be a colonel.
In many cases, yes, and it wasn't necessarily the expense. You just had to have the influence to do it, to convince people that you were fit to lead them into combat. And, of course, the first people to get the jobs were those who were already officers in the Army or who had been and resigned and went to civilian life. So you had many people that were familiar with Army structure, even though they weren't capable at the scale they were going to be needed. Of course, those were preferable to the single biggest block other than military trained or former military. The profession that provided the most Civil War generals was what?
Politics.
Law.
Law, that's correct, yes, sorry.
Lawyers and, I guess, by extension, politicians. But again, if you were a politician and you controlled a large electorate, making you a general, north or south, is probably a good idea because you're going to have your constituency come with you.
A good example, congressman notorious for his odd behavior before the war with the son of Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Dan Sickles.
Yeah. Dan Sickles, a Tammany Hall politician, one of what we would consider a worst example of a corrupt politician imaginable, had the influence and the money, in his case, to raise the funds to create what he called the Excelsior Brigade at the time. And so he basically bought his way in. But he turned out to be a pretty decent battlefield general. Others, Benjamin Butler and Nathaniel Banks, both Democrats, became major generals in the Union Army because Lincoln needed loyal Democrats to help support what many saw as a Republican war.
Now, obviously, throughout the 1,000 or so generals that we had to have during the war on both sides, in addition to the politicians, lawyers, businessmen of influence, there were, of course, people who had attended one of the military colleges, West Point, the Citadel, VMI being the three best known. And these really provided a solid leavening of professional military personnel.
Almost half.
Did they not?
Almost half, one half of the men, North and South, who became generals were graduates or attendees of one of the various military academies.
And in terms of how they were ranked from a talent standpoint at the beginning of the war, what was the best way to get to be a general fast? What would you have been to have become a general in a day when the war started?
Political support. When Fort Sumter gets fired upon in April 1861, there are very few generals in the Army. Lincoln immediately calls for 75,000 volunteers to put down the rebellion. Well, 75,000 is increasing the standing army by a factor of five, because it was only about 15,000 absent the officers. So this is huge. And so each state got a quota. So Illinois, for example, had to raise six regiments. Well, because of that, Illinois is entitled to a certain number of brigadier generals, and that's the way they were doled out at the beginning of the war, state by state. Some people immediately, because of who they were appointed because of necessity, but others, that's the way each state got its quota. And so throughout the war, promotions would come from a lot of political lobbying, and of course the appointments to the rank of general had to, and this is true on both, in both armies, had to be approved in the Congress. So the president could appoint you, but if Congress didn't agree, guess what? You're not a general.
do we love oversight? In addition, of course, there was a certain amount of, shall we say, toteming within the Army itself. For example, if you had been one of those smart guys at West Point and got to be an engineer, you were considered a very valuable individual, and the engineers grabbed what can only be described as a very heavy quota of the top spots at the beginning of the war.
Ultimately, actually, by the end of the war, most of the top commanders, with a few exceptions, were engineers.
And
engineers
included
were viewed as the elite. But again, West Point was an engineering school. Tactics, military tactics and strategy were elective courses.
And what kind of men were these academy graduates? Where had they come from, and what had their academy experience and army experience, including the Mexican War, made them into?
Well, they were a small contingent of very proud men. They came from all walks of life. To get a nomination to West Point, your congressman could appoint one person from his district. And then, of course, you had to survive the rigors of the examinations and the demerit system at West Point to make it through. A lot of classes had a big attrition rate. To come through West Point, even as the GOAT or the last man standing, you know, bottom of the class, you were still quite something. And these guys knew it. To survive a West Point education was something. But then they got stuck into a small army with intense rivalries amongst themselves and very slow promotions. So you could be... You could come out as a brevet second lieutenant from West Point, and it may take you 10 or 15 years to rise to the rank of captain.
And you were just talking about the guys who were the GOATs. Just to make it clear, yes, Robert E. Lee was at the top of his class and set a standard that cadets at West Point still try to reach today. But some of those GOATs wound up being surprisingly good generals during the Civil War, including the guy who set, I believe, the all-time record for the most demerits and lowest grades, a young gentleman from Michigan. You know who I'm talking about.
You're talking about George A. Custer.
Exactly.
And yeah, he was flamboyant and popular and liked to play, but he was smart enough to know how many demerits he had and what the zero line was, and he always managed to stay on the right side of the line. Whereas Lee was prim, proper, and would not besmirch. I think he got zero demerits at West Point, which is almost impossible.
Yeah, I mean, and yes, let us not kid ourselves, he did have a family history that dated back before the Revolution, and there were just very high expectations for the young man. But as first a cadet and later as commandant there, his record was absolutely unblemished as long as he was there on the Hudson River.
And that's why when he said something, it mattered, because you might not like him, you might not agree with him, but you certainly had a respect. When he told you not to do something, he was practicing what he preached. So he wasn't going to tolerate any nonsense.
At least prior to Fort Sumter, as you say, he practiced what he preached. We'll talk about him here in a minute and perhaps revise a few people's minds on his wartime performance. These men also, whether we like it or not, whether they liked it or not, they became a very intimate group of people, friends, and sometimes family through intermarriage, right?
Right. As I said, it was a very small, close-knit community. The officers at any given post were a family. They boarded together, they ate together, they served together, they went into danger together, and they learned a lot of things about each other that would benefit them in the war. I mean, they knew intimate things about each other, warts and all. So if you were brave, they knew it. If you were a coward, they knew it. If you were a drunk or a gambler or a womanizer or whatever dirty little secrets you had were wide open to your peers if you all came from the same post. And then, of course, there was gossip and rivalry. They were a band of brothers, but they weren't necessarily a happy family.
Yes, like all families, there was at least a minimum of dysfunction in them.
Exactly, and maybe more so because their relative positions to each other were based on performance. And you and I come out of West Point at the same time. One of us is going to rise faster than the other, and the other one's going to be jealous or resent it or maybe accept it. But those are all possible things and all very real things.
They also were something else, and let's not go too much into it, but let us say it. America was a very God-fearing evangelical country compared to where it is today. And it would be remiss of us not to mention the strong influence, particularly of Southern Protestantism, upon the personalities of many of the generals who served.
Oh, that's very true, and that's true on both sides of the line. Oliver Otis Howard, who was a Union Army commander by the end of the war, was devoutly religious to the point of distraction to some of his peers. It was a very, very big part of their lives.
Now, one more thing, and that let's not kid ourselves. These were, in some cases, men who very rapidly took on larger-than-life personas. I mean, if anybody who has watched Ken Burns' wonderful Civil War series, which, can it really be 25 years since that came out? Good God. Remembers, yeah, I know that we lived that long, but I still remember a description of Robert E. Lee that in many ways, for all the reverence his men had for him, and they did, they also feared him. The last thing they wanted to do was have to come and stand before the man, as it were.
Oh, sure, again, because he was this... Even then, he had this reputation of being this reproachless being. And, I mean, nobody wants to get called in front of the principal or in front of your dad when you're a little kid. God forbid the commanding general of the Army's calling you. If it isn't going to be a good thing if you're not part of the staff or the high command.
And let's face it, the Union Army commander in the East, George Gordon Meade, after Gettysburg, when he's the first guy who's ever stopped Robert E. Lee in his tracks and thrown him back over the Potomac River with a little velocity, he wound up getting a reputation of, you go before this man and you don't do well, you can get shot. I mean, this is a guy who enforced discipline to the point of killing a few people to make his point.
Yeah, I mean, military executions were one way of making sure that men did what they swore to do when they took the oath to join the Army. And it didn't happen as often as military law allowed it to. President Lincoln commuted many sentences, and many generals were loath to give the death penalty. But on certain occasions, and two or three times during the war, if you read the soldiers' accounts, there are dramatic incidents where these military executions took place, and with effect.
It's funny you talk about that, because at the National Archives facility in College Park, Maryland, a few years back I was doing some research for an Israeli documentary film company, and I had the occasion to go and look at the pardon log that Abraham Lincoln's clerk kept. And, of course, it was amazing, because you go into the hermetically controlled environment. It's sitting there on a shelf next to the files on the Birdman of Alcatraz, the Rosenbergs. I swear, you know, if I'd gone a couple more shelves over, there probably was the Ark of the Covenant. And, you know, it's like something out of a Steven Spielberg film. But the point is that when I sat this massive book down, and I say massive, it's, you know, one of those big ledgers, big leather bound, and went through it, it really was quite amazing to me how many men owed their lives to Abraham Lincoln having a much kinder heart than George Gordon Meade or U.S. Grant.
Or, you know, Braxton Bragg on the Confederate side. But again, Lincoln's opinion was that it was the worst use of a soldier to execute him.
Well, opinions on that varied, and we're going to talk a little bit about the men who had to literally execute those executions. And I'm going to go, and we're going to take a quick break right now. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the generals who did so much during the American Civil War. This is the Right Stream Radio Network, and this is Military Monday.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann, Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Right Stream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can, but we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we are back on Military Monday. We're going to go ahead and talk a little bit about some of the generals in question during the Civil War. If you would like to call in and ask a question of Mr. Girardi or myself, or offer an opinion, not that anybody has an opinion about anything involving the Civil War, give us a call on our call-in line at area code 347-945-7246. Again, that's area code 347-945-7246. And Robert, are you still with us there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Okay, here we get to have a little fun. We're going to start with the Confederacy. And let's start by making a point, and that is there was, in fact, someone in charge of the Confederacy, a commander-in-chief, maybe not with the same powers laid out in Article 2 of the Constitution of the United States, but still, he was a commander-in-chief, and that is a gentleman by the name of Jefferson Davis, himself a West Point graduate and, in fact, a former Secretary of War for the Union. Talk a little bit about him as a commander-in-chief.
Part of the problem, it's kind of funny because he's the opposite of Lincoln in many ways. The fact that he was Secretary of War and an innovative Secretary of War. He was also a hero, combat veteran of the Mexican War. And he was the West Point graduate. He thought he knew best. And so he would, can't use the word meddling when you're talking about the commander-in-chief, but micromanage might be a better term. He thought he knew best, and he wanted things his way on the battlefield, even though he never went. Some of his generals urged him to lead in the field.
Perhaps in the hope that he'd take one for the team.
Now we're reading into it, but in some ways he probably would have been better suited leading an army than a nation.
And it's worth noting that he had very strong personal relationships, and for the people he had those relationships with, he was, of course, very supportive, very sympathetic, even when they lost. His relationship with Robert E. Lee was extremely intimate from a professional standpoint. And then, of course, there were people like Joe Johnson, Albert Sidney Johnson, who he just did not like at all.
Well, there were, see, Davis was loyal to his friends, which became problematic when some of those friends were leading armies. And Albert Sidney Johnston, whom you've just named, was a good friend of Davis. So was somebody named Braxton Bragg, who many people reviled, but whom Davis kept in command long after he should have. And then Leonidas Polk, who was the Episcopal Bishop of Louisiana, but a West Point graduate, but resigned almost immediately after graduating. But he was a friend of Davis, and so he got a high command based on that. Robert E. Lee had to work his way up into Davis's good graces, and Joseph Johnston, whom you also mentioned, and Pierre Beauregard, both of them fell out of Davis's good graces because of their squabbles over issues of rank and glory and other such things that deviated somewhat from the purpose of the Confederacy, which was to win independence.
And let us not kid ourselves, given the Confederacy's focus on states' rights, his powers compared to those of Lincoln were a little lacking when it came to making hard decisions and getting quick results.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that throughout its short life, the Confederacy founded on states' rights had in many ways a much stronger, forceful central government than the U.S.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of the men who served as generals under Jefferson Davis. And we're going to start with the big banana, the one everybody, for all the people who are calling in, yeah, we know who you want to hear about, okay? Let's start it real simply, Robert E. Lee. Make
Robert
an assessment.
E.
And remember, part of why we have you on here is you tend to deal more in contemporary comments, accounts, and reports, not so much what people have reverently written for 150 years since the war stopped.
Yeah, I go back to the people who knew these people and what their commentary and their opinions are. Robert E. Lee, of course, is the great demigod of the Civil War, the untouchable man, you know, the unbesmirched character. I go out on a limb because I don't necessarily support that view of him. Here's a man with one of the FFVs, Revolutionary War hero for a father. He himself is a West Point graduate, so he's educated by the U.S. government. He's employed by them for a number of years, serves them ably, and then in the country's greatest hour of need, they offer him the supreme command of the armies, he being recommended by Winfield Scott, the commanding general of the army, as the most capable man, and he refuses. And instead, he says he's going to remain with his state and not draw his sword again. Unfortunately, he immediately joins the Confederate Army and then raises his sword against the country that educated him, fed him and his family, and also educated his sons. I find it hard to reconcile that, and I don't buy into the he was true to his state argument, because many of his peers, also Virginians like Winfield Scott, the commanding general of the Army, George Thomas, David Hunter and others who were also Virginians remained loyal. So if he was right, does that mean they were wrong?
And let's not kid ourselves. A number of Southern officers chose to stay with the Union. People like David Farragut, George Thomas, and others made the decision that the central government was who they had gone and pledged their fidelity and loyalty to, not a state.
Union. The Union, not a state. That's right. The idea of their country. And
now,
I understand it was a divided, and that's one of the things they fought over. And I don't doubt the sincerity of their beliefs. I just find it hard to see the rightness in it.
Now, as certain members of our listening audience are sharpening their knives and cocking their guns to fire at to go and attack you, let's make it clear, you're not just a guy with an opinion. You've written 9 books on this. I mean, including studies of General Pope and this newest one, The Civil War Generals with Zenith Press. What is it that you, in preparing your newest book, gave you the ability to do assessments like you just did of Robert E. Lee, which quite definitely go against the grain of contemporary and later literature over the past 150 years?
Well, I've got, a lifetime of studying this, and also of reading what these generals wrote, what their peers wrote about them, how they were regarded. Obviously, it's their partisan opinions in many instances, but very true. And what you believe is the truth for you, regardless of what I might believe. And that's where we come into conflict sometimes when we try to force our views upon each other. These are our men. And for me, analyzing this, part of my job is to look through facts and come up with what happened and why, looking at opinions, different witness accounts, somewhere in between there you find out, the real measure. And that's one of the things about this book. The opinions about these generals are from their peers. Most of them are contemporary, some written after the focus was dead so he couldn't respond, but no less valid if the person writing it actually believed it to be true. And most people aren't going to put on paper something they deliberately know is wrong.
Let's continue on to talk a little bit more about some of the other generals we've not yet really talked about. James Longstreet, an interesting character, not beloved in the South for his post-war conversion into a Republican, but generally considered one of those solid generals who actually understood the nature of industrial warfare at that time.
He probably was among the top generals in understanding the nature of combat in the Civil War and both the lethality of the defense, so thereby its strength, but also in how to use the combined arms to get something done. He was a strike force. Lee called him his old war horse for a reason, and that's because he knew when Longstreet hit you, it wasn't going to be with a hammer. It was going to be with a sledgehammer.
And if you tried to hit him, it was like running your head into an anvil.
Yeah. Longstreet's corps were the shock troops of Lee's army. When Longstreet attacked you, you knew you had been attacked. And when you were attacking Longstreet, you knew who was there stopping you. He almost
and
never.
And worth noting that they were the ones who were up on the sunken road at Fredericksburg, and they were the ones who made the charges on the second and third days at Gettysburg.
And also that destroyed John Pope's army at the Second Battle of Bull Run with that vicious attack. Longstreet understood not only how to hit, but when to hit, which oftentimes is even more important. Because I don't have to hit you as hard if I know when to hit you when you're at your weakest.
And yet, at the same time, you in your book, you make the contention that as good a corps and division commander as he was, as an independent army commander, not so much.
No, Longstreet, he was overambitious. Many Civil War generals, again, here's a group of men who knew that in ordinary life it would take them 15 or 20 years or an entire career to reach a brigadier generalcy. And now they were being put in those positions almost immediately, you know, within months in some cases, within days in others. And they wanted as much as they could get because this was going to be their great opportunity. And nobody liked doing what a superior was telling them, especially when they disagreed with it, as Longstreet did on occasion with Lee. He thought he could do better, and he thought he was better than some other generals, like when he went to the West under Braxton Bragg. But when he was given independent command on several occasions, he just didn't measure up. It was beyond his capabilities. He was a good number two man.
A good guy to have backing you up. Let's talk about another Corps commander under General Lee, the beloved and legendary Stonewall Jackson. I speak that with reverence because I am in Virginia. But you again recognize that there were limitations to the man's skills.
Well, Stonewall, again, was a even his most ardent admirers would admit that he was quirky, strange, eccentric, whatever word you want to use. But as a subordinate,
there is the question of sanity and evangelical fervor every time you look at Stonewall and his actions.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he was insane. I think he was a little out there. Definitely evangelical. And that certainly defined him and motivated him much more than almost any other consideration. But Jackson was good in an independent command, whereas Longstreet really was not. Jackson could go understand the bigger picture and go do his part to make it happen. But he kept secrets to himself. His own subordinate generals didn't know what his plans were. His biggest success in the Shenandoah Valley in 1862 came largely as a result of lackluster opposition. He wasn't up against, to use a McClellan phrase, foemen worthy of his steel. He was fighting up against a group of disjointed opposition that were being managed from afar. Many of the generals he was up against didn't have the authority to make their own decisions. They were being managed from Washington, which proved to be a mistake. Even at Bull Run, he was pinned down by Pope, and his men were throwing rocks at Pope's guys when they were hiding in the railroad cut. But he knew Longstreet was coming, and all he had to do was hold on. But he, even though he had gotten in Pope's rear and was threatening him, he was in pretty bad shape until Longstreet came and saved the day by design. At Fredericksburg, Jackson deploys his troops, leaves a flaw in his line, which the Federals breach. They break his line, but they don't exploit it. And so he doesn't get criticized for that. And then again, at Chancellorsville, his vaunted flank march is a big, bold thing that Lee approves. But even so, the guys that he hits are aware that he's there and don't take the necessary precautions or measures to forestall him. And so he gets a great victory, again, pretty much handed to him. And then he dies. So it's kind of hard to find fault. He has this string of victories, but, you know, against other people, who knows? But that's true on any battlefield in any war throughout history.
And certainly one thing he could do to men of his brigade and corps, depending upon where he was at the time, he had that unique ability to do forced marches that approached rates of advance of horse units. I mean, his foot cavalry, as they were called.
Right, and that was his determination to get the job done, regardless of how many men fall out of the ranks. It's get where you need to be with as many men as you can, and the ones who fell out of ranks on the way, they'll catch up. And And one of his subordinate generals, A.P. Hill, does exactly that at Antietam at the critical moment in the battle.
Let's talk about cavalry officers real quick. Obviously, you can't have this discussion without talking about the young Virginia Cavalier, J.E.B. Stuart, who, in your mind, is badly overrated.
Yeah, I think Stuart was a good cavalry leader. He understood what to do with cavalry, screened the army, scout for the army, develop intelligence for his commanders, and he excelled at all that, and I don't belittle that, but I think he was, in many instances, a big kid who never grew up and enjoyed fame more than success. I think it's ironic, in my opinion, his greatest day on the battlefield was not as a cavalryman, but as an infantry corps commander. When Stonewall gets wounded at Chancellorsville, Stuart handles Stonewall's corps flawlessly, and really that's his greatest day on a battlefield.
One wonders what would have happened if he had been given that corps command and had been on the northern flank at Gettysburg on the first day.
Different battle.
Different battle, different fight. The other thing that is not cannot be denied is that he allowed himself to be hunted down and killed. I mean, in that regard, Phil Sheridan, just a year later, literally sets out to go and hunt him down and kill him dead, and he does so.
Yep. There's a couple of differences, though. Again, Stuart's period of greatest success against federal cavalry is at a time when federal cavalry is not organized and being used as a cohesive strike force the way it is when Pope takes command and is the first officer to organize federal cavalry into fighting units as opposed to camp guards and pickets and things of that nature. By the time Sheridan is on his search and destroy mission for Stuart, the federal cavalry outclasses the Confederate cavalry, outnumbers them and outclasses them. The
better mounts, better weapons, better leadership.
Yep, both. Well, not necessarily leadership, but functionality.
And finally, an officer who, boy, you can get more opinions on this guy than anybody else. On the one hand, the one of the greatest cavalry officers in the history of the horse, you know, the horse period of cavalry, and yet someone who later would form and be the first Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Yeah. Forrest is one of those guys you love to hate, even his own side. He's a fractious commander. He's definitely got a killer instinct. I mean, he raises his own units at the beginning of the war, rises through the ranks from private all the way up to lieutenant general with an independent command. I think the only person in the war to do that. He's definitely a force to be reckoned with. He knows how to fight, and his maxims: war means fighting, and fighting means killing. Personally, he kills something like 22 federal soldiers in hand-to-hand combat, and he kills 23 soldiers and loses 22 horses, and at the end of the war says he came out a horse ahead. And this guy's a killer, but he's a bad subordinate, and that's why somebody like Joe Wheeler will be a more effective commander, because he knows how to obey as well as to command, whereas Forrest only knew one thing: his way or the highway. And that's
let's not kid ourselves. By contemporary standards, this is a guy who didn't have a problem committing a war crime along the way to feed his own bloodlust.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little severe, but I'm not saying it's inaccurate. Fort Pillow is a stain on what's hardly a stainless record.
And let me ask you about one guy who probably should have been a general, but nobody ever had a chance to go and catch him long enough to go and pin a star on him. And that's one of my favorite soldiers of the Civil War, a lawyer and future diplomat, John Singleton Mosby.
Mosby. Everybody likes Mosby.
Even the Union guys who hated him loved him when it was over.
Well, you had to respect the guy. Here's a no-nonsense, sort of a soft-spoken guy, diminutive. I mean, compared to a physical giant like Forrest, Mosby's a shrimp. But he's canny. He knows what to do and he knows how to do it. And he's originally serving with Jeb Stuart, who empowers him to form his group of partisan rangers or irregular cavalry and pretty much sends him off into no man's land to wreak havoc and gather intelligence. And Mosby excels at that sort of thing. Small combat, hit-and-run tactics, and he runs Union cavalry ragged for a while. But I'll put in a plug here for the 8th Illinois Cavalry. Our Illinois boys fight him to a standstill. It's the first one opposition force that Mosby respected and learned
well,
to fear.
Well, yeah, and let's not kid ourselves. In terms of the tenets of unconventional warfare, this is a man who stands up on the same podium with Genghis Khan and P.T. Lawrence in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's not unfair. Maybe not with as much notoriety, but he's certainly in the area that was known as Mosby's Confederacy. He was a nightmare for Union commanders trying to move supplies back and forth or to maintain order behind the lines. Mosby was like a stinging wasp that wouldn't let go.
I mean, just a couple of miles from where I live, where this show is originating here, he went into a Union headquarters and basically captured and kidnapped a Union general of his own and took him prisoner.
Edwin Stoughton. That's a great story from Mosby's own memoirs where he enters the – it's a dark and stormy night. No pun intended. That's the way – it was a dark and stormy night. He goes there to capture somebody else but finds that it's a Stoughton there, and he finds him sleeping in bed and slaps him across the backside with his saber to wake him up. And the general wakes up half groggy and says, "Who is it? What's going on?" And Mosby says, "Have you heard of Mosby?" And he says, "Yes, of course. Have you got him?" And he says, "No, I'm him, and I've got you." And
like
he manages,
I said, if there had been a general, Lord knows what would have happened if they'd done that.
Now, in fairness, when Lincoln hears that Mosby has captured a Brigadier General Stoughton and about 58 horses and some other men, Lincoln's comment is that he's more concerned about the loss of the horses because, as he says, I can make brigadier generals, but I can't make horses.
Which takes us a very nice segue. I've got, you're good. You're very good. Keep it up. I'll have you as a guest host. Which takes us to the Civil War generals of the North, the Union Army. And let's start at the top again because your contention, and we'll get to this at the end of the show, is that the Union officer corps wound up being better. Let's start at the top. President Abraham Lincoln, a kind and gentle lawyer from Illinois who suddenly has to go and take a badly divided, badly segmented Union and turn it into a great nation, and he's got just a couple years to do it.
Yeah. I'm not sure how kindly of a lawyer he was. You wouldn't want to come up across him in the courtroom. But Lincoln has, compared to Jefferson Davis, has zero military experience. He served about a month as a captain during the Black Hawk War, leading a militia company. And Lincoln says that the only blood loss he ever sustained was from mosquito bites. So here's a guy that's unskilled and knows he's unskilled in military matters, but has the wisdom to consult. So he'll lean heavily on Winfield Scott, who's the Army's general, and he'll reach out, reading military books to try to learn on his own when he realizes that he can't find a general who's willing to put his policies into play on the battlefield. He'll even go visit New York and bring back a relative fossil, Ethan Allen Hitchcock, to consult him on occasion as to what should be done. And so Lincoln leans heavily upon other people as well as himself to try to learn what Davis knows.
And he, in the end, turns out to be a very, very good talent scout. It takes him a couple years, but he eventually does figure out the formula and the mix of talent to go and win, not just in the West, not just in the mountains, but to go after Robert E. Lee, the guy who turned him down to be the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army. He eventually puts together a bevy of generals that match the Confederates man for man and beats them. I mean, let's start with the guy who wound up winning the big one, U.S. Grant. Now, okay. Let's say if you had been there in March of 1861 in Galena, Illinois, and you had seen U.S. Grant walking down the street, what would you have seen?
You would have seen a slouched over man, middle-aged at the day. He was 35 or 36 years old, walking around in shabby clothes with a hangdog look on his face because here's a man that's failed. He left the Army under disgraceful circumstances, had failed in almost every other endeavor, and he's after failing on his own farm, which his father-in-law gives him in Missouri, he's reduced to selling firewood on the streets of St. Louis and ends up going to Galena to work in his father and his brother's leather goods store. So here's a guy.
He is a substance abuser at this time.
Always in debate. There's no doubt he couldn't handle liquor when he consumed it, which was probably more often than he ought to have.
So,
but bring up that's like besmirching Lee's character. You end up in a whole divisive sideshow.
And I'm sure someone will
shoot the
fire
because he was
got past my ear for that. But okay, so this is the guy, not right away, but within a very short time after Fort Sumter, is back in the Army and suddenly begins to find a war that fits his mind. It's his calling.
Right. It's about the only thing that he really excels at. But I think it's partially one of the things that makes Grant is the fact that he was a failure. He knew that you could fail and it's not the end of the world, whereas some people were so afraid of failure that they couldn't risk success. Grant understood failure, but he also understood it made him simpler than some of the other generals in some ways, and I don't mean that as a derogation of him. He knew he could get the job done with what he had by just putting his shoulder and pushing, and he excelled at that.
And there was...
And he's allowed to grow.
Yeah, there may not have been quite the powerful intellect of some of his West Point classmates, but there was a common sense reasoning to the man that we talked about on the phone the other day when he went and when he was just a brigadier. Talk a little bit about that moment because it's maybe one of the most beautiful things in his brilliantly written autobiography where he realizes the nature of war.
Yeah, Grant is probably more so than any other general. I've never heard anybody else write this. He's got a small command. He's in Missouri. He's going into combat with his command. He's going up over a hill. He knows on the other side of the hill is the Confederates. He's afraid of what's going to happen when he gets there. And he writes that with every step as he's going up the hill, his heart is getting higher and higher in his throat. And with the anticipation and fear of what's going to happen. And then when he gets to the crest of the hill and looks, he sees that the Confederates have evacuated their camp and fled before him. And he writes that at that time, it was something that had never occurred to him, but which he never forgot before, that the enemy was as afraid of him as he was of them. And that was an idea that had never occurred to him before, but which he never forgot afterwards. And that's very true. That's a paradigm shift in his thinking that many other generals might have benefited from. Grant wasn't afraid of the enemy. He was thinking about what he was going to do, not what they were going to do to him. Sure, he'd circumvent what their potentials were, but his main thing was to go for the throat.
And he becomes the first Union general who gets the idea, hey, guys, I can be the boogeyman. I can ruin your day, your life, and I can take this war anywhere I want, right up to your front door. And
yep.
It's not just that he does it for himself. He infuses this in all the other leaders, especially generals that he winds up commanding for the rest of the war.
Yeah, he's able to put together a team of people he trusts to get the job done. But again, Grant benefits because Grant in Virginia in 1861 is put on the shelf and never heard from again. In the Eastern Theater, generals were given one shot, hit or miss, to win. Grant was able to grow into the job in the West with some successes, some failures, under a cloud for a while, ultimately given the chance to succeed that very few generals in the Eastern Theater were ever given.
Going back to Abraham Lincoln, who got criticized for continuing to support Grant even after some of those failures and not exactly desirable results, Lincoln sees something in him, doesn't he?
Yep, because, and again, think of Lincoln's mentality. Here he is, the premier army in the country is being commanded by, we haven't talked about McClellan yet, but McClellan won't see it Lincoln's way. He won't use his army to do what Lincoln needs him to do for both military and political reasons. All he's getting from McClellan is excuses. Whereas here's Grant, who's taking what he has and doing something with it, win or, you know, succeed or fail. And when Lincoln hears the commentary about Grant's drinking or problems and he needs to go, Lincoln's comment is, I can't spare this man. He fights. And Lincoln needed a fighter.
And,
Lincoln,
of course, some
you
famous
lose,
comment about sending
fought.
A barrel of whatever he's drinking to all his other generals.
Right. Well,
and you mentioned the next guy on my list.
Documented. The other is more myth.
But you bring up the other top general in the East for most of the war prior to Grant taking command, that being George McClellan, who on paper should have been the white knight, who should have been the guy who did it all and would in a couple of years be president, the great warrior from New Jersey. And yet, as good an organizer, trainer, and inspirational leader, just couldn't make that army. He couldn't get himself to move that army, and he couldn't get himself to commit that army.
Now, not the way that it needed to be done. He would do it, but only on his own terms. And there's a constant power struggle between him and Lincoln. But McClellan never seems to have adopted the idea. Although he did it when push came to shove at the very end, he subordinated his own aims to Lincoln's will. But prior to that, he's really trying to challenge Lincoln's authority as commander-in-chief. And had there been anybody, as even Lincoln realized, anybody that Lincoln could have leaned upon, McClellan would have been gone a long time before he was, for that very reason. McClellan was a direct challenge to presidential authority.
And for some of the comments that he made, which I think the word seditious is not too strong a term, at least if you believe what Stephen Sears has said.
Stephen Sears and Richard Slatkin more recently in a great book on McClellan and that whole period prior to the Emancipation Proclamation. If McClellan is not treasonous, there is certainly an air of treason around his headquarters on a daily basis, which he does very
little. A culture of command not interested in the goals of the national leadership.
Not interested, diametrically opposed to it.
Let's talk about a general you have a great deal of knowledge about because you've written a book about him, Pope. Talk a little about him, what the situation was he was thrown into and what happened, because he was a victim of that one chance in the East and out scenario that you talked about.
Pope is the Lincoln's antidote to McClellan and McClellanism in the summer of 1862. for two or three reasons. Number one, Lincoln knows Pope. Pope's father, Nathaniel, was the federal district judge in Illinois, and Lincoln had tried many cases in front of Nathaniel Pope, actually read the eulogy. John Pope is a Republican as opposed to McClellan being a Democrat. Lincoln knows Pope. Pope is one of a handful of officers that ride to Washington with Lincoln on the inaugural train ride. And Pope has risen from a captain of engineers in the pre-war army to a major general. He's won a number of small but important victories in on the Mississippi River. And he's one of the fighting generals that Lincoln brings, a guy I know, that I trust, that knows how to fight and will do it. And he brings him to the East and gives him a new army, basically to supplant and replace, ultimately, McClellan. But he saddles Pope with three mismatched subordinates who have all been proven failures, and also, for good or ill, Pope makes the mistake, probably at the direction of the Secretary of War, issues a bombastic proclamation that immediately puts him under a hailstorm of criticism on day one.
Let's go and talk about a guy who may have been the only general that everybody thought less of during the war than Grant at the start of it, labeled at the very least mentally unstable. Not well thought of. Just his name around Atlanta will get you dirty looks today, 150 years later. William Tecumseh Sherman.
Sherman is one of those improbable generals. He's a West Point graduate. He's very skilled. He's very opinionated. He's got a mind. He's got a genius of a mind. He instantly understands concepts. He knows terrain. He understands logistics. But during the Mexican War, when all of his peers are gaining combat experience, Sherman's a quartermaster and gets none of that. So Sherman never has practical combat experience. At the beginning of the war, because his brother John is a senator from Ohio, in a meeting with Lincoln, Lincoln offers to make Sherman a brigadier general. And Sherman, you know, we talk about these ambitious guys. Sherman says, thanks, but no thanks. I'm not qualified for that. And instead, he accepts a colonelcy. And he fights at Bull Run as a colonel of a regiment. And that's his first real exposure to combat. After Bull Run, he becomes a brigadier general. He gets sent west to Kentucky and Tennessee area, where Robert Anderson, the guy who surrendered Fort Sumter, is in command over his head, and he brings in Sherman to be his backup guy to do the dirty work. And Sherman looks around, and he's of a very nervous disposition, but he sees what the Confederates are doing. He's aware of the vast amount of geography he's got to defend, and he says it's going to take 200,000 or 300,000 men to beat the Confederates. Of course, that's insane, and the newspapers so label him. But as it turns out, Sherman underestimated the number it would take.
Sherman, at various times, is not the most imaginative of operational commanders. Certainly, if you look at the course as he approaches Atlanta in early 1864, it looks like a pinball going down the middle of a bowling alley, back and forth, bouncing off the terrain as he's being fought, you know, tooth and nail during the approach. And yet, burn Atlanta, starts the Great March in the second half of 1864, and he commits what is arguably the greatest piece of soldiering, not only of the American Civil War, but maybe of the entire 19th century. Talk a little bit about this man, how he could be so blunt and, shall we say, unimaginative in the first half of a year, and in the second half of the year, he writes the book on Blitzkrieg.
Yeah. Again, Sherman is a guy that can't fight a battle. He's got absolutely no concept of moving armies on a battlefield to advantage. His straight ahead and see what happens approach fails. He does understand flanking maneuvers, though, and there's your pinball, trying to go through the various gaps and get on the Confederate flank. He does understand trying to gain a position of advantage. But when he gets that position, he's afraid to commit his whole army. Here's the inability to pull the trigger and throw everything at it on one great gamble. He's always hedging his bets, and therefore he's never very successful. However, he's relentless, and his campaign can't be stopped. And when he realizes the nature of the Confederate States at Atlanta, he's seized the prize at this point, and the Confederate Army is marching away from him. And he's being told from everybody, from Lincoln to Grant, to go stop the Confederates. And instead, his policy is to, no, let's go the other direction. There's enough force behind me to deal with him. I can end this war by showing these people that I can't be stopped. And that's what he does. He marches across the South at will, fights very few battles, pushes everything out of his way, destroys important infrastructure and resources that prop up the Confederate war effort, and basically has a big picnic marching from Atlanta all the way to Savannah.
And cuts the Confederacy as it was in 1864 in half.
He undermines to some degree their will to fight, because the soldiers in the field who are, they're going to forge this new nation, and they're getting letters from home, help me, because the Yankees are coming and they're taking everything we have. We're starving. Our houses are burned. Our cattle are gone. The pigs, chickens, everything is gone. And we can't stop him. There's nothing there to stop him.
And as much as the cry of the Yankees are coming could be heard in a lot of places, that thing we talked about with Grant, Sherman became the boogeyman of the entire war.
Oh, yeah, and even today, the outrageous overestimates of the damage he inflicted, many people believe he did a lot worse things than he ever actually did, but he made his point, and it's an indelible point.
We're coming to the end of the show, but we do have to talk about a couple of people. Phil Sheridan, you're not a big fan of his, are you?
No, I don't like Phil Sheridan. Phil Sheridan is a capable combat commander, but he's one of the nastiest individuals you'll encounter in the Civil War. Personality-wise, I think he suffers a little bit from little man complex. He's very short. Lincoln describes him as being tall, not enough neck to hang him, and his arms so long he can scratch his ankles without bending over if he wants to. But in the saddle, leading men into combat, Sheridan is every bit as good as anybody else. But he is a glory hound, makes Jeb Stuart look like an altar boy, and he's not above destroying men whom he views as a threat or whom he just doesn't like.
Yeah, Governor Kay Warren at the very end of the war, who
yeah.
I think, and you and I both agree, was probably a pretty darn good corps commander and was doing solid work. Just because he didn't move fast enough to suit Sheridan, Sheridan cashiered him.
Warren is the biography that I co-wrote on Warren will be out later this year. It's not that Warren didn't move fast enough. It's that they were diametrically anti each other. Sheridan and Warren did not like each other going all the way back to the Battle of the Wilderness. Sheridan looked for any reason and was empowered by Grant to find or trump up any reason to get rid of Warren, and he did, and it was unjustified. Warren moved. The record shows that Warren did everything it was possible for him to do, and he did it well. And at the moment of winning the Battle of Five Forks, Sheridan will relieve him of command and say he wasn't even on the battlefield. And then later in a report, impugn Warren's honor and integrity just because he didn't like him. And then block his means of redressing that. So Sheridan is not a nice guy.
let's do one last general, and then let's close up. My favorite cavalry general of the entire war, beautifully and amazingly played by Sam Elliott in the movie Gettysburg, Brigadier General John Buford.
Yep. Buford is one of those guys that, had he lived, there might not have been a Sheridan in command of Federal Cavalry in 1864. Buford is a hard-nosed, no-nonsense guy, knows what it takes to lead cavalry. He's lucky that when John Pope comes east in 1862, Buford is given command of Pope's cavalry and actually is allowed to organize it into the strike force that it will be. And he does great service for Pope. Unfortunately, Pope runs him ragged, and so when Pope needs him the most, Buford can't deliver, and it's not Buford's fault. But at Gettysburg, which will be his great shining moment, Buford, that's basically Buford's battle. He decides the ground. He holds it. He buys time for the rest of the army. He confers with Reynolds on the nature of the ground. Reynolds concurs. Reynolds gets killed. And so Buford is still pretty much running that battle. It's amazing what he was able to accomplish. It's just, unfortunately, illness took him prematurely just when he gets promoted general. But Buford had a future in front of him had he lived.
And, of course, his achievements during the entire campaign, particularly in what we call the Battles of the Gaps along the Blue Ridge Mountains, his cavalry gave incredible service and reconnaissance information to first Hooker and then Meade. I mean, once he started getting engaged, he kept engaged. This is not a guy you had to encourage to go stick his neck out.
No, but he wasn't going to fool around either. He's one of these guys that, I mean, everybody talks about Forrest with dismounted cavalry. Buford is doing that in 1862. Fighting his cavalry dismounted, fighting them as infantry, but using the mobility of the horses to get them where they need to be. And he's just a tenacious, hard-nosed fighter, and he's got a team that understands that and respects that. So he's really a strike force. He dies prematurely, but otherwise probably, arguably, one of the best cavalry commanders of the war.
We need to wrap up here in the next couple of minutes, but let's just take a minute and tell me who had the best generals, North or South?
The myth is that the South started the war with all the best generals. I disagree. I think the Union benefited both from the number of generals and the skill sets that they brought to the war. So the Union, by far and large. South had a couple of superstars. Union had a team.
Fair enough. And I guess as we come to the end of the show, the question is, what is next for you? I mean, obviously, you finish here, you're probably going back to your desk as a homicide cop, but what are you doing in the writing business here in the next year or two?
Well, I've got several projects that I'm trying to bring to fruition. The Warren biography will be out at the end of the year. I'm currently editing the Civil War letters of John Eugene Pope, another Galena general, and probably the guy that got Grant into the Army at the beginning of the war. He's a dynamic guy that stays in the Army until 1882. He's instrumental in bringing in Red Cloud, and he's very active in the Indian Wars. So that's one project. I'm working on the Civil War letters of Washington Roebling, the builder of the Brooklyn Bridge, dynamic writer. Very few people have ever utilized his writings except peripherally. What a dynamic writer he is. He's on Warren's staff and actually marries Warren's sister. So that's another project. And I'm doing a book that's kind of a corollary of the Civil War generals, which is what they wrote about each other. It's more of an assessment of them as commanders, a book I'm calling Civil War Corps Command, where I will look at generals in the higher rank of both armies and rate them as to their abilities and effectiveness in that position. And that's just three. There's several more. There's four burners on the stove for a reason, and I use them all.
Rob, I want to thank you for being here. We appreciate you and Zenith Press for providing you. And let's hear you again later this year when your next book comes out, okay?
My pleasure. Thank you
so
much.
Take care, and thank you for coming on Military Monday.
You are very welcome.
And with that, folks, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. Thank you for supporting this show. Thank you for listening to this show. We'll be back next week, same time, and I guarantee you we're going to have a great summer of people coming to visit us. This is the Right Stream Radio Network.